If you will, turn please to Job chapter 30. I hope to get through chapter 34 tonight. And that'll leave us about 8 chapters to get done in 3 more classes. Because we're going to lose New Year's Day, we're going to lose Christmas, because those will be devotional and singing days, and we're going to lose the 5th Sunday of the month, because that's a singing class or singing occasion. And I want to save the 4th. We actually have 4 after today, and I want to save it for a closing lesson on why Job died happy. So we're going to try and cover a lot of territory in the next little bit. We are in a section, verses 16 to 23, where for the third time, Job was emphasizing the contrast between his past and his present. And of course, there is a big difference in those two things. And we'd gotten down to verses 18 and 19. And those two verses read, "With great force my garment is disfigured. It binds me about like the collar of my tunic. God has cast me into the mire, and I have become like dust and ashes." What Job is feeling there seems to be that he is in a knock-down drag-out with God. He has a diseased body, and that diseased body is very uncomfortable, to say the least. And in these verses, he reaffirms that God has caused his pain and has caused his suffering. At least that is Job's understanding. In verse 20, "I cry to you for help and you do not answer me. I stand and you only look at me." Job cries out to God, but God does not break his silence. This, of course, is one of the things that in life for most of us, and probably for Job, is something that adds insult to injury. God's silence is interpreted as being indifference and a lack of concern about Job and his condition. Maybe Job has just forgotten for a little bit that true prayer has at least 2 parts. And those 2 parts are crying out, and the second one is waiting. Because we often, as we pray to God, wait for God to answer or respond to it. Verse 21, "You have turned cruel to me. With the might of your hand you persecute me." Job is expressing the fact that God has really, in his mind, become cruel. The image suggests that he's falling, and this is the language that is used, and the meaning of the language is that Job is falling into enemy hands, and he is being gradually and progressively infected with new and more intense pain. And certainly that describes Job's situation. Verse 22. "You lift me up on the wind, you make me ride on it, and you toss me about in the roar of the storm." We all know that Job knows about storms because it wasn't a storm that his children died. He now saw such a wind, and it was a wind that would blow him away until he disappeared. God was treating Job as Job had described God's treatment of the wicked back in chapter 21 and verse 18. This verse has a great deal of difficulty in it, by the way. And there are various translations that are made of this verse, the 22nd verse. The New English Bible was the first Bible, I think, to come out in modern language. And the translators of the New English Bible admitted to guessing their way through unintelligible Hebrew in interpreting this particular verse. But I think that what we have suggested is probably about as close as we can get. Verse 23. For I know that you will bring me to death and to the house appointed for all the living. Well, verse 22 has its difficulties. Verse 23 is perfectly clear in what it has to say. Death is personified, and it may be personified here, but this does not make it a God outside of the Lord's sphere. God is still God, and death is still death. Sheol is vividly called the house appointed for all the living, and that's simply the grave, and that simply is where all of us are going. It's appointed unto man once to die. And that is true of every single one of us who is here, from the youngest to the oldest. Whatever happened, he would see Sheol from which none was going to return. And he's been telling us that since chapter 10, verses 21 and 22. Even so, Job was sustained by the conclusion, recall this chapter, I think it's 19, that his Redeemer lived, and that without his flesh he would see him. And it is chapter 19, verses 25 to 26. Verses 24 to 31, Job is facing death, and he's cried out for help. Verses 24 and 25, yet does not one in a heap of ruins stretch out his hand and in his disaster cry for help? Did not I weep for him whose day was hard? Was not my soul grieved for the needy? One commentator said that this verse makes other difficult verses look easy. When you look at different translations, there are hardly two versions that agree. Dietrich, wrote his commentary, first published back in 1949, was considered, and I think probably still is considered, a good Hebrew scholar. But one commentator, after reading the four pages that Dietrich wrote on this verse, said that he seemed, when he came out, as confused as when he went in. And that may be correct. I don't know. But it does demonstrate that the verse has some difficulties in it. One said that perhaps the best understanding is that of a commentator by the name of Francis Anderson, who said in light of verse 25, it could present the picture of a person in ruins, stretching out his hand for help, which no common humanity could deny. Job certainly would not deny that kind of help to people, because we know from what has been written and what has been said that Job was a man who always helped those who were in need when he had the wherewithal with which to do it. And he always listened to them. He didn't wait for them to come. He looked for them. Verse 26. But when I hoped for good, evil came. And when I waited for light, darkness came. Hardly do we need any explanation of that. But the picture is that Job is seething within. He's boiling within. His anxiety has raged. He had no respite. If faith is always having peace and quiet and confidence in God, where does that leave Job? I think the answer is that faith does not always leave us in those wonderful conditions. You may recall from the New Testament, blind Bartimaeus and the Canaanite woman in Matthew chapter 15. Bartimaeus back in Mark, over in Mark chapter 10. But when they came to Jesus for help, they didn't come to him in the sense of going to a lottery and hoping somehow they were going to hit it big and they would get that for which they were looking. What they did was they approached him as the only one who could help them and who could provide that which they did need. Verses 28 to 31. I go about darkened, but not by the sun. I stand up in the assembly and cry for help. I am a brother of jackals and a companion of ostriches. My skin turns black and falls from me, and my bones burn with heat. My lyre is turned to mourning, and my pipe to the voice of those who weep. The closing verses of this chapter enlarge on Job's plight. His skin is blackened, but it's by disease, it's not by the sun. He stands up in the assembly and he cries, but nobody hears. He's a brother to the jackal and a companion to the ostrich, which basically says that these are his only companions. The only thing that he has to be with are the wild animals. His disease, not the sun, blackens his skin. His bones burn with fever. His lyre or harp had turned to mourning, and his flute to the sound of those who weep. Job had absolutely no joy from an instrument that was used for celebration. There just wasn't any joy before him. His joy had turned to mourning completely. And he could no more produce different music than a Mozart sonata could be played on a bagpipe. And if you're familiar with that music, you know that that is an impossibility. Chapter 31 has been called Job's ultimate challenge. There are 40 verses here, and I think we can go over them pretty quickly. Some suggest that this chapter might be called Job's Sermon on the Mount. It covers everything from lust and adultery to loving one's neighbor, including alms, social justice, love of money, other idolatries. It's a priceless testament and is fitting consummation of the words of Job. It's an oath of clearance in the form of a negative confession. A negative confession was a well-known procedure or practice that was used in ancient jurisprudence. A crime could be disowned by someone who was charged by calling down a curse upon himself if he had done that evil deed. And so that's what Job is doing here. As we go through the verses, we'll discover that. A crime could be disowned by calling down the curse. It was addressed to God in an appeal against human judgment. Chapter 31 lists specific crimes, and Job denies every single one of them. Job evaluates every area of his life, and he doesn't leave any stone unturned. Verses 1 to 4. I've made a covenant with my eyes. How then could I gaze at a virgin? I don't know how much you recall from hearing people talk or preach about Job, but this is one of the verses that gets a lot of preaching done. Maybe used in a way that Job's not using it here, but still, I think, an appropriate use. I've made a covenant with my eyes. How then could I gaze at a virgin? What would be my portion from God above and my heritage from the Almighty on high? Is not calamity for the unrighteous and disaster for the workers of iniquity? Does not he see my ways and number all my steps? One thing we need to remember here as we think about these four verses is that an Eastern prince could do anything to anybody that he wanted to do. He could treat them any way he wanted to treat them. He could treat them well. He could kill them, whatever he wanted to do. And Job is saying that's the way it is. Now, what will God, who sees all of this, think about it? Job's conduct is different. He speaks of his thought life, what he thinks, how his mind works. He looks into the inner recesses of his heart as he speaks in these verses. He is examining the inner man, and he is the only one who can do it. His friends can't do it. They didn't do it, and they've said everything they're going to say. Elihu, who is fixing to come on the scene, is going to talk to him and talk about it. But he never can look into the inner heart of Job. Now let's stop for a minute and think about ourselves. If I, as an individual, am going to have my inner man examined and hopefully improved, there's only one person other than me who knows what that inner person is, and that's the God of heaven. And if I'm going to improve my inner man, the only way it's going to be improved is if I work with God to bring about an improvement in my inner man. Verses 5 to 8. If I have walked with falsehood and my foot has hastened to deceit, let me be weighed in a just balance and let God know my integrity. If my step is turned aside from the way and my heart has gone after my eyes, and if any spot has struck to my hands, then let me sow and another eat, and let what grows for me be rooted out. Now notice the things that Job is saying there. If I've done this, then let this happen. If I've done that, then let that happen to me. And that's the negative confession that Job is making. Job has here turned to his ethical life, we might call it his professional life in some respects, his life at the office or in that which he did for his prosperity. But God is a witness to his integrity. We'll talk about that in verse 6. It was obviously present back in chapter 2 and verse 3. And it's evident here. Verses 9 to 12. Job's home life is laid out. If my heart has been enticed toward a woman, and I have lain in wait at my neighbor's door, then let my wife grind for another and let others bow down on her. For that would be a heinous crime. That would be an iniquity to be punished by judges, for that would be a fire that consumes as far as Abaddon, and it would burn to the root all my increase. Job says, I have been faithful to my wife. And you'll remember the role his wife played earlier when she told him to curse God and die, but he was faithful to his wife. Job loved his wife. He wasn't like a bunch of modern folks who, when not with the one they love, love the one they're with and think nothing of it. But Job says, I've been faithful to my wife, and again, it's a negative curse. If I haven't been, if I have gone off with my neighbor's wife, then you let my wife grind for another. And that's a nice way to say, let another man have my wife. That's a pretty strong negative confession that Job has made there. Particularly since adultery is a sin that is punished certainly by God and sometimes by man. And certainly by God, both in this life and in the world to come. Verses 13 to 15, Job's work life. If I've rejected the cause of my manservant or my maidservant when they brought a complaint against me, what then shall I do when God rises up, when he makes inquiry? What shall I answer him? Did not he who made me in the womb make him? And did not one fashion us in the womb? Job says, I had people working for me. I had servants. And if they came with a complaint and I didn't answer them and take care of them, then the God of heaven will take care of me because I have done wrong. But Job always did that which was right in those respects. God has witnessed to it. Verses 16 to 23, Job's community life. If I have withheld anything that the poor desired, or have caused the eyes of the widow to fail, or have eaten my morsel alone, and the fatherless has not eaten of it, far from my youth the fatherless grew up with me as with a father, and from my mother's womb I guided the widow. If I have seen anyone perish for lack of clothing, or the needy without covering, if his body has not blessed me, and if he's not warmed with the fleece of my sheep, if I have raised my hand against the fatherless because I saw my help in the gate, then let my shoulder blade fall from my shoulder, and let my arm be broken from its socket. For I was in terror of calamity from God, and I could not have faced his majesty. There's his negative confession again. Wherever in my community people needed help, I was always there for them. And if I was not there for them, then you let God do to me what I deserve. And you heard as I read what Job said he would have deserved if that had been the case. 24 and 25, Job's financial life. If I have made gold my trust, or called fine gold my confidence, if I have rejoiced because my wealth was abundant, or because my hand had found much, if I have built my life upon my wealth, and I've looked at that and I've rejoiced, that's been the thing that really has made my life, then God will get me. Beginning verse 26 to 28. Some refer this as his spiritual life. If I've looked at the sun when it shone, and the moon moving in splendor, and my heart has been secretly enticed, and my mouth has kissed my hand, this also would be an iniquity to be punished by the judges, for I would have been false to the God above. He was one who served his God. And he describes ways in which, had he done those things, he would not have served his God. But had he done them, he should be punished by the judges. Job has never hypocritically covered sin, verses 33 and 34. Somebody's changed my Bible somewhere. Oh, I just skipped some. That's what happened. Verses 29 to 32, Job's social life. If I've rejoiced at the ruin of him who hated me, are exalted when evil overtook him. I have not let my mouth sin by asking for his life with a curse. If the men of my tent have not said, who is there that has not been filled with his meat? He takes care, Job takes care of all the people around him. His social life is one that is aware of and of a service to those who need him and who depend upon him. And then verses 33 and 34, Job is not hypocritically covered sin. If I've concealed my transgressions as others do, by hiding my iniquity in my bosom, because I stood in great fear of the multitude and the contempt of families terrified me, so that I kept silence and did not go out of doors. That is to say that he always, if he did something wrong, he would admit to it, and he would not hide it from, couldn't hide it from God, but he wouldn't hide it from the people around him, and he would make amends for it. Then finally, verses 35 to 40. Oh, that I had one to hear me. Here is my signature. Let the Almighty answer me. Oh, that I had the indictment written by my adversary. Surely I would carry it on my shoulder. I would bind it on me as a crown. I would give him an account of all my steps. Like a prince, I would approach him. If my land has cried out against me and its furrows have wept together, if I have eaten its yield without payment and made its owners breathe their last, let thorns grow up instead of wheat and foul weeds instead of barley. Job endorses every word by his negative confession in these verses as being true. But as we reach this point, Job's response to his friends is over. His final challenge to God has been made. He's had his say. He spent all his breath. He's learned at least this much. The process of becoming a true individual involves dying to oneself. One must exhaust all of his energy, all the energy of the flesh, and disappear and leave himself in the presence of and in the care of God. Chapter 32, we've got the new kid on the block. His name is Elihu. Elihu is rather long-winded. It's going to be about four chapters of what he has to say. And what we know, as well as what we don't know, about Elihu raises a number of questions. Elihu is coming on the scene late. How well did Elihu know Job and his friends, his comforters? How did Elihu find out about Job and his losses and his sickness? How long had Elihu been sitting there, if he had been, and I think he had, and listening to what was being said back and forth between Job and his comforters? Did any of the previous speakers, the three friends, did any of them pay any attention to Elihu as he sat there, assuming he did, waiting his turn to speak? Why is he just mentioned in six chapters, chapters 32 to 37? And he's not mentioned anywhere in the beginning. He's not mentioned anywhere in the end. Were his words ignored, or were they so profound that they ended the discussion? We'll find out as we look at what he says. We're not going to answer all of these questions for a number of reasons. One would be time. But even a bigger reason is that the text doesn't answer any of those questions directly. Elihu appears to be impulsive. He's cocksure. He is a know-it-all who claims to have all of the answers. He recklessly charges against his elders, the friends, without adding any substance to the conversation that had been had through these chapters. He doesn't appear to be any more sensitive to Job's problems and situation than those who had spoken before. And he doesn't add any new or any fresh dimension to the conversation. And I guess most important, he doesn't offer a solution that the others had failed to offer. Verses 1 to 5. So these three men ceased to answer Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. Basically what that says is, look, you know, we've tried, but we failed because Job won't listen to us. We keep telling him he's got real trouble because he's wicked, and he keeps telling us he's not wicked, that he's a righteous man. And if he's not going to listen, we're not going to talk. Then Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite. Now, one thing I hate about teaching here is that we got Hebrew scholars here, and I've just mispronounced names all over the place. But be that as it may. He was of the family of Ram, burned with anger. He burned with anger at Job because he justified himself rather than God. God hadn't justified him as far as Elihu knew. Elihu apparently wasn't present when God was speaking and telling the devil, I don't have anybody in this world like Job. He's a righteous man. But Elihu didn't know that, and the friends didn't know that. He burned with anger at Job because he justified himself rather than God. He burned with anger also at Job's three friends because they had found no answer, although they had declared Job to be in the wrong. Now Elihu had waited to speak to Job because they were older than he. And when Elihu saw that there was no answer in the mouth of these three men, he burned with anger. Now, there is a little suggestion there that Elihu did have a little bit of humility. But I sort of think it was false humility. I waited because y'all are older. But in a very nice way, he said, but you're also stupid. The question was, do I think he was a teenager? No, I think he's probably older than that physically. But that leaves mentally to be suggested or to be discussed. Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite, answered and said, I don't know why God made me answer the, pronounce those words twice. I am young in years and you are aged. Therefore, I was timid and afraid to declare my opinion to you. I said, let days speak and many years teach wisdom. But it is the spirit in man, the breath of the Almighty, that makes him understand. It is not the old who are wise, nor the aged who understand what is right. Therefore I say, listen to me. Let me also declare my opinion. Elihu is angry with Job. He's angry with his three friends. Of course, the friends had a very difficult time because it's difficult to find a solution when you're opposing God and Job, and both God and Job are right. Elihu had at least waited to speak in deference to the older men, but he was surely ready when his turn came. His youthful modesty was excelled only by his youthful assurance and exuberance. One man described it, and I think that's a pretty good description. Verses 6 to 28 are an apology for his intervention. Could Elihu's first words be false humility? Yes. His humility doesn't go well with his anger. The only words missing at the end of the verse, of verse 7 was, "But I was wrong." He clearly did not think that the three friends knew what they were doing, and they had no wisdom to speak. However, he had knowledge. Knowledge is the word that you'll find in the margin of the New American Standard Version. Most of them translate that opinion. I have an opinion. New American Standard translates it, "I have knowledge." And I sort of think maybe that that's what Elihu was thinking about himself. "I'm the smart man, I'm the wise man, and I'm anxious to share my wisdom." He apparently believes that his knowledge came from the breath of the Almighty. Look at verse 8. "But it is the spirit in man, the breath of the Almighty, that makes him understand." Well, Elihu says he understood, and so it must have come from the breath of the Almighty. Wisdom belongs to God. It doesn't belong to age. And so you can't judge wisdom by how old a person is. And that may well be true in some respects. But all things being equal, it's not true. If you don't think that Elihu was very proud instead of humble, read these verses carefully. "I, me, and my" dominate his speech, occurring more than 50 times. He was convinced that he had a message and urged them to listen. Excitement was apparent in his language. He was so happy to be there and get his turn. He told the friends that they had miserably failed to convince Job that he was wrong. Verses 11 to 22. "Behold, I waited for your words. I listened for your wise sayings while you searched out what to say. I gave you my attention, and behold, there was none among you who refuted Job or who answered his words. Beware lest you say, 'We have found wisdom. God may vanquish him, not a man.' He has not directed his words against me, and I will not answer him with your speeches. They are dismayed. They answer no more. They've not a word to say. And shall I wait because they do not speak? Because they stand there and answer no more, I will answer my share. I will also declare my opinion, for I'm full of words." Underscore that in your Bible. "The spirit within me constrains me. Behold, my belly is like wine that has no vent, like new wineskins ready to burst. I must speak that I may find relief. I must open my lips and answer. I will not show partiality to any man or use flattery toward my person, for I do not know how to flatter, else my maker would soon take me away." Elihu waited for the friends to finish, listened to their reasoning, gave them apparently his attention, but he didn't hear anything that refuted what Job had said or answered his words. But he added, "Job's not the place to find wisdom either. God has wisdom, and God may vanish Job, but no man can do it." Job has not directed his words against Elihu, so he says, "I can't answer his arguments with your speeches." We've more bombast for Elihu beginning in verse 15. We certainly expect something more impressive than we get after the big buildup that Elihu has given us. Verse 18's really striking. "I am full of words." Folks, nobody questions that by now. After you hear what Elihu has started with his big speech, the spirit within him doesn't seem able to constrain very much. In fact, it seems like he can constrain absolutely nothing. A figurative description of his impulse to fix. He talks about the wine. There certainly is a lot of vinegar in Elihu's wine. Verses 21 and 22, he'll speak plainly without flattery. And after we read what he has to say, that needs to be modified just a little bit. He will speak plainly without flattery except for himself. He has plenty of flattery for Elihu. But he says, if I do that, then God's going to take me away. Ooh, I didn't get as far as I wanted tonight. Chapter 33, Elihu rebukes Job. Job and Elihu are both mortals. Both are formed by God's Spirit. Yet he is going to be the answer man who answers Job. This is verses 1 to 7 in chapter 33. He's the ultimate expression of sincerity, verse 3. He assures Job that he's human, belongs to God. Thus Job need not fear him, and his pressure should be not weigh heavily on Job. Note the admission in verses 6 and 7 that he's putting pressure on Job, but he says it's not going to be too much. We'll start with verses 8 to 12 in chapter 33, and I will guarantee you next week we're going to move. And I'm probably going to quit reading the chapters and just start not just summarizing them like I've been doing, but just giving you some of the meat and moving on toward the end, because we need to get to God's participation in this, and we'll do that in chapter 38.